Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
Always fun to travel in on a holiday weekend. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. Welcome to our program here on The Fan. Hopefully you have nice plans on tap for this Labor Day weekend. You can enjoy it safely with family or friends. Joining us appropriately enough at this time of the year, Rick Posner. His background's in the field of education. He's going to share some insights with us. Contained in Lives of Passion, School of Hope. He taught for 30 years at Jefferson County, Colorado Public Schools, was an assistant principal of the Open School. And his perspective, I think, is a good one. Maybe we'll get some insights as well for those of us who work in the field of education. Welcome to our program, Rick.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
In beginning this discussion, I'll ask the simple question that a lot of people who've listened to discussions that I've done on this program, especially in the past year, probably are familiar with. It's a very simple question that starts us off. This book at this time in your career, why was it important to do this?
Well, it was important for me for a lot of reasons, a lot of personal reasons as well. As you know from my background, I taught for many years in conventional school settings, and when I came to the Open School as a transfer teacher in the 80s, it really saved me as a teacher and as an educator, and really turned my life around. So in a personal way, it's important for me to give back to a place that transformed me. I think in a political social context, it's important now because I think we're hitting a dead end with our so-called educational reform methods. I think No Child Left Behind is headed for a wall. I think people are starting to react to it. There's a backlash going on. And I think what we're really doing is leaving a lot of kids behind. So I think it's important to for us to look at some alternatives in public schools to the one-size-fits-all option that's becoming more standardized and narrowing the curriculum every day. The curriculum gets narrowed when it should be expanded. So we need some examples of some schools that have worked that are out of the box. And I think I've provided one here.
All right, let's go back to the very beginning of that answer, and I appreciate you being as frank as you were in providing us with that answer. You mentioned the fact that this saved you. What do you mean exactly by that term, saved you?
Well, you know, I think I was at a point with teaching. I was a special ed teacher in conventional school settings, some of them large public schools. And what I felt like in those settings was a defense attorney for my kids. I was really beating my head against the wall trying to defend and advocate for these kids who just didn't fit into this one-size-fits-all system. And I was getting frustrated by it. I was a good teacher. I really loved my kids and advocated strongly for them. But I didn't believe in beating our heads against the wall, against the system that just seemed empty to me. It was all based on standardized testing and grades, and so little of it was really based on the personal and social aspects of the kids. It was all teacher-centered. It was really a forecast of the way things have become in education. I could see where things were heading. So I was really at the end of the line, and like a lot of kids who don't fit into the system, I ended up coming to the open school as a person who felt the same way. I felt like I was a refugee from the conventional school system. And what I found at the open school was a family and a community of learners, where everyone was a learner and everyone had special needs and everyone was taken seriously as part of the community. And so it really changed me around, and it showed me what the possibilities were. And it also gave me a family to belong to, which was so important to me at the time.
You yourself, why did you, I mean, this kind of sets maybe in a way sort of the basis for some of our discussion. I always like to try to get as much information for people listening to us as well as for myself in discussions like this. Why did you first go into education?
Well, you know, I sort of went in through the back end. I was one of those kids from the 60s. That was rebelling against everything. I was from a fairly affluent family from the Midwest. I went to University of Wisconsin during the 60s. You can imagine what that was like, a very political place, you know, a lot of things going on politically and socially at that time. And I sort of ran away, you know, from it all, and came out to Colorado and just wanted to, you know, make it on my own, so to speak. And I became a bus driver. I was a college graduate, but I really wasn't prepared to do anything or trained to do anything. I had a degree in sociology. I became a bus driver. I became a janitor. I took what jobs I could get in the community I was living in. And through bus driving and janitorial work, I was in schools. I was working for school districts. And I was hanging around kids. And I realized that I liked kids, and I got along well with kids. So I had the idea of going back and getting my teacher's degree, teacher's certificate, becoming a teacher. So it was sort of a back-end way of doing it. And I think I got into teaching for the reasons that most people get into teaching, that you like kids, and you like to get along with kids, and you like to get to know kids. Not so much that you love math, if you're a math teacher. I mean, that's important, too. But the kids come first.
And when you think of what you gained from the experience with the Jefferson County Open School, one area where I want to focus our discussion is there's a lot of different things that you cover in this book, but what is it that you think you gained as knowledge about the way that students learn best?
Well, you know, part of it sort of reinforced what I did well as a teacher before I came to the open school, but didn't have the system behind me to back me up in what I was doing. And that is that kids learn best from people that they care about and people that care about them. I think that's putting it in a nutshell. But that really the personal and social aspects of learning are so important, and they're so often ignored. I think, Bob, I think what really happens is the elementary model itself is pretty good the way it stands, where you get to know one teacher pretty well, and you know who you can go to if you have a problem. But then the message at the middle school juncture, when you transition to middle school, is usually, listen, the fun and games are over now. The affective part of education is over now. We got to get serious now about academics. And really, it's exactly at the wrong time to give that message. Adolescents are the ones who really need a lot of that affective feedback, and they need relationships, positive relationships with adults at the school. And, you know, as we know, so often these kids are coming from families where they don't have any positive relationships. And schools can provide these things, and that's the hook for learning. That's the part of learning that really comes alive and makes it personal. When you help kids find out who they are and help them make sense out of their world, not just to throw facts and dates at them.
Hmm. And part of the way in which the open school functions, as I understand it, is not relying on giving credits or giving grades. That'll shock some people. Some people would be thrilled by that idea, believe me. And there probably are some teachers that would be thrilled by that idea as well. How is that received? And the other aspect of that naturally is, then how does that affect kids when they move on to higher education?
Yeah, well, how is it received? I mean, that's interesting because, you know, the open school is a school of choice. And again, I talk about options in the public schools. There should be more of them, lots more of them. Unfortunately, a lot of the options these days are back to basics kinds of academies, you know, where the focus is entirely on academics. We need more options in our public schools, that's for sure. So how it's received, you know, it's received by the people who come to the school because they make a choice to come there. It's a school of choice, and it's usually a philosophical choice. So they come knowing that this is a non-graded school. So, and remember that the school is a pre-kindergarten through 12th grade program. So we get to acculturate kids very early in the idea that they will not be getting letter grades or credits. So the whole idea is to develop this love of learning that does not depend on other directed kinds of assessments. That really what we're trying to develop is this intrinsic sense of motivation and self-assessment. That really, when you become an adult, that's what a lot of people struggle with is, you know, you don't have somebody looking over your shoulder all the time and giving you grades. You really have to take a good look at yourself and be self-reflective and self-assessing.
Rick Posner is talking with us on our program this morning. I'm Bob Salter. Ann Liguori is along talking golf after our 7 o'clock update this Sunday morning. We're in discussion with Rick Posner in this portion of our program. Rick is the author, as I mentioned at the beginning of our program, of Lives of Passion, School of Hope. Before we paused, you were talking about the fact that one of the challenges we face as adults is this whole idea of the importance of being, as you put it, self-reflective.
And those are some of the major skills of successful people. Stephen Covey, in his book, The 7 Traits of Successful People, talks about self-assessment all the time. So that whole culture of not having grades and doing some self-assessment is there to begin with. And so it's accepted by the people who make the choice to come there. Of course, it looks strange from the outside, looking in. And then the other part of your question was what happens to these kids when they want to go to college or they want to get into programs where they usually require grades and grade point averages. Well, I have a whole section on that in the book with college, and the truth is that they end up getting into the schools that they want to get into. Sometimes it's tricky, but what they do is they write their own transcripts. In other words, they write a narrative transcript of everything they've done at the school, usually put into the framework of growth, personal growth themes. So admissions counselors at colleges get a very in-depth look and personal look at the kids who are applying. And Bob, you know, really over the years, over the last 10, 15 years, colleges have become more focused on that. They've looked at portfolios. They want to hear what the kids do outside of school. At the open school, that's what kids do inside of school. What most people call extracurricular, we call the curricular. They really want to get to know all about someone who's applying these days. So the trend has been in our favor. But I'm not saying there haven't been problems, and we've had to do some hard work with admissions people. But it's paid off in the end.
When you use the term that there, or the statement that there should be more options in public schools, do you see any indication that that is happening?
You know, I think slowly but surely we do see that with the charter school laws and the proliferation of charter schools, that's been a boon to our progressive movement. It's provided lots of opportunities. I think at the same time, we've been fighting against the trend towards standardization and towards high-stakes testing. So it's sort of a mixed bag with the charter schools. As I said, what I'm afraid of is that most of the charter schools are these back-to-basics academies in my opinion, go the wrong way. But I think what the hope is that there's starting to be this backlash against No Child Left Behind. And I think what people will be looking for and seem to have started looking for are schools that pay attention to their kids and spend some time getting to know their kids. Because as we all know, kids are all smart and all have talents, and with multiple intelligences and the discussion about different kinds of intelligences, we're looking at a lot of kids being ignored and made to be invisible because of this uniform, homogenous way of looking at education. So I think there's hope there. I think that's part of the trend now.
One of the things that struck me most in reading this work, and for those who've just joined us in our discussion, we're talking with Rick Posner on our program, talking with him about the book Lives of Passion, School of Hope, How One Public School Ignites a Lifelong Love of Learning. I go back to 1999, an event that, when I mentioned the name, everybody connects with in one way or another, the Columbine tragedy in Colorado. Share with people listening to us today exactly what happened with the student body of the open school.
Well, you know, when such a tragedy occurs, and it was such a shock to everyone not just in the school system, of course, nationwide, first real graphic example of school violence. Took place in a very affluent part of Jefferson County, which is a large geographical county that stretches from rural to more urban kinds of settings. This was in what, probably the most affluent area. It was a shock to everyone, and it was interesting to see how the school system reacted, at least initially. They had all these meetings, and and said, "What happened? How did this happen? And how did these kids go under the radar? Why didn't we know about this? That it was brewing?" And you know, they kept talking about counseling systems. And, they actually used the word advising, and that's a word that's very sacred in the open school and always has been. And they were looking for answers that they already had examples of at the open school, and that is the advising system, where every student in the school has a personal advisor that they can go to about anything, and that they are accountable to, and that the advisor is accountable to them. You talk about accountability, that's it, right there. So no student at the open school goes unattended or gets the chance to hide out like these Columbine killer kids did. And the reason they were able to hide out was because they were good students. They got good grades, they got decent grades, they were college bound, they were from good families. If they had gotten into trouble, of course, they would have, you know, seen an advisor or, a counselor, probably someone who didn't really know them. But they didn't really know who to go to in the school. They felt alienated, angry, like so many kids do. And they acted out, obviously. Now, the reaction was, you know, more metal detectors and more security guards. Eventually, that was the reaction. So it was a reactive approach. It wasn't a proactive approach, obviously. Now, the open school, when that happened, we took it very seriously and had school meetings about school violence. We talked about what was going on because our curriculum is based on the real world and things that happen. They become the curriculum. You don't just go back to your, advanced algebra class when something like this happens. So the whole school got together in a school governance at the open school is the students run the show. They run the governance meetings. They are the governing body of the school. So they got the whole school together, pre-K through 12, and said, "Listen, we're going to make a stand, and we're going to have a march that commemorates the victims of this violence, and we're going to show that we are supportive of the victims and their parents, and that we come from a place that we take this very seriously." And what they did is they organized a march, and it was about 5 miles from the open school to the to Columbine High School, and they marched along the way. And this is the whole school taking part in this. And no other school in Jefferson County took part because they did not want to spend time away from their curriculum. For us, it was the curriculum. So it really made a statement about what schools should be about and what they can be about.
It also made a statement in my mind about the way in which student government functions, because a lot of the time we've probably been used to the idea that student government was simply built around, you know, campaigns, elections, and when you got right down to it, in most cases, was all about a popularity contest.
Well, exactly.
Here you're talking about student government dealing with real issues.
Oh, exactly. And Bob, the powerful thing about student governance at the open school is that it's voluntary. Any kids who want to join student government can join. It's not an election, and it's open to everyone. And they run all the meetings, and the kids are even involved with hiring staff, and hiring administrators. And they have an equal vote with the adults on the hiring committees. Now, that is real student power. But it takes a lot of faith and a lot of belief in and a lot of respect for students and their potential to be involved and to be in control of some things in their lives and to make some important decisions. And I think that's really what the school's all about.
Rick Posner is talking with us on our program on The Fan this Sunday morning. And Liguori's Talking Golf is along after our 7 o'clock update. Rick is the author of Lives of Passion, School of Hope. In his background, he taught for 30 years at Jefferson County, Colorado Public Schools. He served as an assistant principal at the Open School there as well. And pretty insightful perspectives that he is sharing with us on our program this morning. Ann Liguori is along talking golf after 7 this morning. I'm Bob Salter. We are in discussion with Rick Posner on our program. In his background, he's had a background in education. One of the things that you've been involved in, you were assistant principal at the Open School. And there's an interesting concept with there because the students were actually involved in the formulation, implementation, the teaching in the classroom. Is that correct?
You know, students very, very early on at the school get a chance to, at least organize some groups around things they're interested in. They may, kids who are interested in music at second grade level, although we don't really use grade levels like that, but at that age level would organize some groups of like-minded kids around music and have to do some presentations of music they were involved in or liked or some things they knew how to do with instruments or something. And then later on, of course, it develops as the passions and interests of the students develop, that they always have an opportunity to teach a class or organize a group around their interests with the help of a teacher as a guide, and always with a sponsor or an adult. And a lot of the alumni that I talk about in the book, some of whom are in their 50s now, say that was one of the most valuable experiences at the school. The idea that they were allowed to teach what they were really passionate about and share that passion with others.
And keeping track of those alumni from the Open School, what kind of areas, or is it diverse, that they focus in?
For vocations and work? Yeah, I think it's somebody said, well, God, 35, almost 40% are in the arts or education or social services. And I'd say, that feels good to us as teachers because the whole school is about teaching and learning. So we do have what looks to be a little lopsided amount of alumni who are involved in teaching or the arts, things that are based on the learning process itself, which they have so much respect for now as adults, and the arts, because they were allowed to pursue some of those artistic passions of theirs without somebody saying, hey, now, that's okay for a hobby, but this, you can't be serious about this because you'll never make a living doing this. So I like the way it turns out. I like the way it looks. But we do have our share of workers. We have plumbers and construction workers, and we have some doctors and some lawyers and our share of professionals and some business people. I think it's a pretty good range.
When students graduate the Open School and make that move into quote unquote the real world, what is that transition like? And I mean, is there any sort of obstacle or obstacles that they commonly face?
Yeah, I think that they, and I talk about that in the book, it's an interesting transition. And, you know, I think that some of the difficulties are the result of growing up in this very nurturing, strong community. It's almost like having another family, really. The idea of it takes a village to raise a child kind of thing. So when you leave the village, so to speak, you're entering a world that is not quite as personal. And some people have different values. And you've been in this world where you've had this shared sense of values about things. And it can be difficult. But what I found with the alumni is they all felt, or most of them felt, they had the strength of conviction in what they had experienced. And they had the love of learning and the idea that life is an adventure and that they're constantly rediscovering the joy of learning and finding out more things about themselves and self-discovery kind of thing. That's kept them on an even keel. Not to say that it hasn't been difficult for them. Because really, just the basic way of people relating to each other sometimes can be difficult to get used to. When you're accustomed to being open and honest about things and talking about your feelings. So it can be sort of a shock to the system. But the core values are there to carry the alumni on.
The voice of our guest in this portion of our program, Dr. Rick Posner. He is the author of Lives of Passion, School of Hope. Kind enough to be our guest on our program. Thank you very much for joining us. And hopefully some of what you've shared may inspire some of the people listening to us to check out this book. Certainly the best with your work.
Thanks so much, Bob.
We're joined in this portion of our program by Kim Rosen. Been looking forward to speaking with Kim for some time. She's going to join us to talk with us about Saved by a Poem, The Transformative Power of Words. She's the author of this presentation. First of all, it's nice to have you join us on our program.
Really happy to be with you, Bob.
Simple question to get us started. Putting together this work, two thoughts. One, what was this like for you? And secondly, why did you do this at this point in your life and your work?
What a great question. Putting it together, there's two answers of it. It was incredibly rewarding because I felt like it brought together all my years of work, which were seemingly in many different areas. They all came together in this one area of how to allow a poem to become a teacher of self-discovery for you. I'd been a therapist. I'd been a sort of explorer, pioneer of consciousness, done a lot of different kinds of spiritual work and inner work. I also, before that, was a director in the theater, and I taught acting. Before that, when I was a little child, I was a poet. That happened very, very fertilely until I got to high school, when all of a sudden it seemed that poetry had something to do with dactylic tetrameters and iambic pentameters, and all of a sudden my love of poetry disappeared. And I felt like poetry was this code that people in a secret club could crack, but I wasn't part of it. And so I gave up on poetry. I went into theater, and then, as I say, I went into consciousness. And to answer your second question, the reason I write it now is that in 1994, as Pablo Neruda says, and it was at that age, poetry arrived in search of me. I was in a very, very dark depression, and all of my studies and discoveries in the fields of psychology and spirituality somehow could not touch the place I was living in myself at that time. And as you can imagine, it was a huge despair because I was a teacher of self-discovery, and yet I could not discover how to free myself from this depression. And I had one of those experiences that, you know, you can only call a miracle, where one day as I was cleaning my house, I found this battered cassette tape with no name on it, threw it in the cassette tape recorder. I don't know if your listeners remember those things.
Oh, my goodness. They weren't even, a lot of them weren't even born.
Weren't even alive, right?
Cassette tape recorder. You're talking about technology from the last century.
I know. We have to study history here. Threw it in the cassette tape recorder, and this voice speaking poetry filled my house. And it was speaking a kind of poetry. This man was speaking a breed of poetry that I had never been taught in high school or college, and it was a breed of poetry that spoke directly to where I was in myself then. And the man's name was David White. He lives in America now, but he was brought up in England. His mother was Irish and his father was Welsh, and so he had this whole background of poetry. You know, in every other country in the world, I would say, I know that's a great claim, but it's possibly true, poetry is much more central to the culture than it is in America. So David had been learning poems by heart throughout his whole life, and I decided I would do that, not really thinking anything other than I was completely uncreative in every way in my life at the time, and so I figured I'd use my will to memorize poetry. And what I didn't realize would happen, but what did happen, was that these poems that I started to, I thought I would memorize them, I started to learn them by heart. The Buddhists call it writing on the bones. And they came so deeply into me that they were the healers that took my depression and opened it and introduced me to a healing process so that I was really healed from the inside out by these poems.
When you talk about poetry to people who, I'm trying to think of the right way to phrase this, but for lack of a better term, say that they just don't relate to poetry. Some people will say they don't get it, you know, doesn't turn them on, whatever. What do you say to them?
Well, I love that question because, as I said, I have been one of those people for so many years. First thing I say is that I'm not so sure it's true, because most of these people who say, oh, I can't relate to poetry, I just don't understand it, I open up the New Yorker and I look at those poems and I go, wow, what does this mean? And yet, there are prayers, there are psalms, there may be texts from the Bible or the Quran or the Talmud that speak to people. There may be lyrics from songs. Listen to this. Moons and Junes and Ferris wheels. The dizzy dancing way you feel when every fairy tale turns real. I've looked at love this way. You know, we most of us know that as the lyrics from Both Sides Now by Joni Mitchell. There are songs that we play over and over because we love the lyrics. And all of these are poems. Every scripture was written in poetry to begin with. Every prayer, every psalm, every lyric. So I think most of us do relate to poems, and we just don't call them poems. And the other thing that I find very interesting is that, especially I think in America, we have somehow gotten the idea that we're supposed to understand poetry with the left side of our brain. You know, the left side is the side that's dedicated to linear, practical, factual thought. And the right side of the brain is the side that's dedicated to image, to feeling, to relating, to the ineffable, you know?
Kim Rosen sharing some interesting thoughts on poetry with us on this Labor Day weekend morning. Hopefully, as I mentioned earlier in our program, you have some nice plans on tap for this holiday weekend. One of the nice things about this weekend and especially about Sunday morning, and it has been a very nice occurrence throughout this summer. Hopefully you've been enjoying as well Ann Liguori's Talking Golf program. That's long after our top of the hour update here this morning. A lot of us have certainly picked up perhaps a renewed or in some cases a new passion for the sport as we listen and learn, and enjoy, too, Anne's conversations surrounding the topic and the sport of golf, and also just feeling the passion that she has for the sport, too. comes through loud and clear. Hopefully by now you have downloaded the radio.com app so you don't have to miss any editions of that program or anything else that happens here on The Fan. That's going to do it for our program. Hopefully you will have a great rest of your holiday weekend, and we'll see you next Sunday morning here on The Fan.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detecttheSOS.com to learn more.